I was still astonished to find that at death all that was done in way of ceremony was that the dead were placed on the ground. I assumed that, in the humid air of Venus, aided by insects and internal decay, bodies would soon lose their flesh and find their way into the soil. But it was still disconcerting to see Devel pulled from the machine by Jarell, stretched out on the soil to be left. Jarell wept over him, violently. Then she was through. She left him, as she said, to become one with the all. I convinced her to stretch his cloak over him, though she thought it was a waste of material. I know how this makes her sound, but I assure you, this was custom. I guess it was a little bit similar to some American Indian tribes leaving the corpses of the dead on platforms to be consumed by time and elements. We traveled forward. The sky had completely cleared and the storm had moved on. We could hear it in the distance, roaring at the trees and the sky. I don't know how long we walked, but finally we came to a clearing in the wilderness. And in the clearing were mounds of giant bones. Some were fresh enough that stinking flesh clung to them. Others had almost disappeared into the ground itself. Teeth gleamed in the sunlight. In the distance, the dark rain clouds moved, as if stalking something. Lightning flashed, and thunder rolled, and the wind sighed. "It's a kind of graveyard for the great beasts," Jarell said, looking around. It was indeed. It went on for what I estimate to be 10 or 15 miles long, a half mile wide. We had brought some supplies from the crippled flying sled with us, and we found the shade of some very large and well-aged bones, sat down in the shade the bones made, ignored the smell from still-rotting flesh, and ate our lunch. It was an odd place for a meal, but our stamina had played out. We sat and Jarell talked about Devel. It was minor stuff, really. Childhood memories, some of it funny, some of it poignant, some of it just odd, but all of it loving. She talked for quite a while. When our strength was renewed, we continued. I guess we had walked about a mile among the bones when we found her uncle's airship. It was blackened and twisted and smacked down among a rib cage that looked like the frame of a large ship. The man I had seen before, the one who had been driving the craft, was still in it, though some creature had been at him, had actually sucked the flesh from his head and face. But it was him, I could tell that, and if I had any doubts, Jarell dismantled them. She drew her sword and cut off his fleshless head and kicked it into a pile of the bones. "Traitor," she said. I saw then not only the beautiful woman I had fallen in love with, but the warrior. And it frightened me a little. "The question," I said, "is where is your uncle?" "Wait. Look there." A little farther up among the bones were the wrecked bodies of several birdmen, blackened and twisted and scorched by fire. "The lightning hit them, same as us," I said. "Maybe your uncle was killed." But we didn't locate his body. Perhaps a beast had found him. But it was also possible that he was journeying on foot to the kingdom of the Varnan. "This means we might catch up with him," I said. Before long, I spied his tracks in the soft soil, pointed them out. Jarell could find Varnan without tracking her uncle, but it was him and the talisman we wanted, so the tracks were encouraging. It was near night when we finally passed the lengthy stacks of bones. We edged toward the forest. The trees, low down and high up, were full of ravaging beasts. But the open land worried me most. Anyone or anything could easily spot us there. Edging along the trees, moving swiftly and carefully as possible, we were taken aback by the sudden appearance of half a dozen beasts with men mounted on them. My fear had been realized. They spotted us. The beasts they were riding looked remarkably like horses. If horses could have horns and were shorter and wider with red and white stripes. They were guided in a way similar to horses as well, bits and bridles, long, thin reins. The riders were seated in high-set saddles, and as they came closer, it became apparent they were not human at all. Humans have flesh, but these things had something else. Their skin was yellow like Jarrell's skin, but it was coarse and gave one the impression of alligator hide. They had flaring scales around their necks. Their features were generally human-like, but their noses were flat as a coin, little more than two small holes. Their foreheads slanted, and the tops of their heads peaked. Their mouths were wide and packed with stained teeth, and their round eyes were red and full of fiery licks of light. They were carrying long lances tipped with bright tips of metal. Short swords with bone handles bounced in scabbards at their hips. Closer yet, I saw there were little glowing parasites flowing over their skin like minnows in a creek. Jarrell said, "Gaul minions. They are eaters of human flesh. Robbers. They run in packs. And they smell." They came ever closer. Jarrell was right. They did smell, like something dead left under a house. "Ah," said the foremost rider, reining his mount directly in front of us. The others sat in a row behind him, smiling their filthy teeth. "Travelers, and such a good day for it." "It is," Jarrell said. "We thought a stroll would be nice." The one who had spoken laughed. The laugh sounded like ice cracking. He had a peculiar way of turning his head from side to side as if one eye were bad. When the sunlight shifted, I saw that was exactly the problem. He was blind in that eye, no red flecks there. It was white as the first drifts of snow in the Rockies. "How is your stroll?" said Deadeye. "It's been warm and it's quite the hike," Jarrell said. "But it has been amusing. It has been so good to speak to you. We must be on our way. We wish you good day." "Do you now?" said Deadeye. He turned in his saddle and looked back at his companions. "They wish us good day." The companions laughed that similar laugh, the one that sounded like ice cracking, then made leathery shifts in their saddles. "It's good to see we're all in a cheery mood," Jarrell said. When Deadeye turned back to us, he said, "I am cheery because we are going to kill you and eat you and take your swords, but mainly we're going to kill you and eat you. Maybe we'll start eating you while you're alive." "Of course we will. That's how we like it. The screams are loud and the blood is hot." "You will dance on the tip of my sword," I said. "That is what you will do." "And what are you exactly?" said Deadeye. "A black man." "I can see that. Were you burned?" "By the fires of hell. Perhaps you would like a taste of hell itself." "What is hell?" I had wasted my wit. "Never mind," I said. "Let us pass or..." "I will dance on the tip of your sword," Deadeye said. "Exactly," I said. "What about the rest of us?" he said. "Shall they dance as well?" "I suppose that between our two swords there will be dancing partners for all of you." This really got a laugh. "He is not joking," said Jarrell. "We will be the judge of that," Deadeye said, "for we are not jokesters either." "Oh, I don't know," I said. "You look pretty funny to me." My comment was like the starter shot. They came as one in a wild charge. Jarrell and I worked as one. We seemed to understand the other's next move. We dodged into the trees, and the Gaul minions followed. The trees made it difficult for them to maneuver their beasts, but we moved easily. I sprang high in the air and came down on the rider nearest me with a slash of my sword, severing his head, spurting warm blood from his body like the gush from a fountain. Jarrell lunged from behind a tree and, avoiding the ducking horned head of one of the mounts, stuck it in the chest. With a bleeding sound, it stumbled and fell, rolled about kicking its legs, tumbling over the fallen rider, crushing him with a snap of bone and a crackle of bumpy skin. That was when Deadeye swung off his steed and came for me, driving his lance directly at my chest. I moved to the side, parried his lance with my sword. The tip of his weapon stuck deep in a tree, and the impact caused him to lose his footing. When he fell, it was never to rise again. I bounded to him and drove my sword deep in his throat. He squirmed like a bug stuck through by a pin. His white eye widened. He half spun on my sword, spat a geyser of blood, shook, and lay still. The others fled like deer. "Are you all right?" she asked. "I am. And believe it or not," I said, "fortune has smiled on us." For Jarrell, riding one of the beasts was uncomfortable, and she rode awkwardly. For me, it was like being back in the cavalry. I felt in control. The creatures handled very similar to horses, though they seemed smarter. That said, they had a gait similar to mules, making for a less smooth ride. "You call this fortune?" Jarrell said. "If your uncle is on foot, yes," I said. As we rode on, in front of us, the clearing went away, and a mountain range rose before us. It was at first a bump, then a hump, and finally we could see it for what it was. The mountain was covered in dark clouds and flashes of lightning. All of it seemed to the sound of rumbling thunder. The patches of forest that climbed up the mountain were blacker than the trees that gave the Black Hills of the Dakotas their name. The day moved along. The sun shifted, and so did the shadows. They fell out of the forests and grew longer, thicker, cooler, and darker. A few of the shiny bugs came out. We shifted into the woods, found a spot where old wood had fallen, and made a kind of hut of trees and limbs. We dismounted and led our animals inside through a gap. I found some dead wood and pulled it in front of the opening. I chopped a lean but strong limb off a tree with my sword and used it to stretch from one side of our haven to the other. On one side of it, I placed our mounts, the limb serving as a kind of corral. After removing their saddles and bridles, I used bits of rope from the bag of supplies we had brought from the wreck of the sled to hobble them, a trick Jarrell had never seen before. Finally, we stretched out on our side of the barrier with our cloaks as our beds. We lay there and talked, and you would have thought we had known each other forever. In time, the night wings were out. They flew down low, and we could hear their wings sweeping past where we were holed up. Many of the bugs outside slipped in between the gaps of fallen wood and made our little room, such as it was, glow with shimmering light. Jarrell and I came together at some point, and anything beyond that is not for a gentleman to tell. I will say this, and excuse the dime novel feel to it: my soul soared like a hawk. Next morning, we were up early, just after the night wings and the glowing bugs abandoned the sky. We saddled up and rolled on out. From time to time, I got down off my critter and checked the ground, found signs of our quarry's tracks, remounted, and we continued. By the middle of the day, we had reached the mountain and were climbing up, riding a narrow trail between the great dark trees. The weather had shifted. The dark clouds, the lightning and thunder had flown. As we rode from time to time, I saw strange beasts watching us from the shadows of the forest, but we were not bothered and continued on. Late in the day, I got down and looked at our man's tracks, and they were fresh. Our mounts were giving us the final edge on his head start. "He is not far ahead," I said, swinging back into the saddle. "Good. Then I will kill him." "Maybe you could just arrest him." "Arrest him? Take him prisoner. No, I will kill him and take back the talisman. I figured she would, too. The trail widened, and so did our view. Up there in the mountains, nowhere near its peak, but right in front of us at the far end of the wide trail, we could see the city of the Birdmen. The great trees there had grown, or been groomed, to twist together in a monstrous wad of leaves and limbs, and mixed into them was a rock fortress that must have taken thousands of Birdmen and a good many years to build. It was like a castle and a nest blended together with the natural formations of the mountain. In places, it was rambling. In others, tight as a drum. I said, "Before we come any closer, we had best get off this trail and sneak up on our man. If we can jump him before he enters the city, then that's the best way. And if he's inside already, well, it's going to be difficult, to put it mildly." Jarrell nodded. And just as we rode off the trail and into the dark forest, a horde of Birdmen came down from the sky and into the thicket with a screech and a flash of swords. Surprised, we whirled on our mounts and struck out at them. It was like swatting at yellow jackets. I managed to stick one of the creatures and cause him to fall dead, but as he fell, his body struck me and knocked me off my mount. I hustled to my feet just as Jarrell ducked a sword swing, but was hit in the head by the passing hilt of the sword. She fell off her beast and onto her back and didn't move. I went savage. I remember very little about what happened after that, but I was swinging my sword with both skill and insane fury. Birdmen lost wings and limbs and faces and skulls. My sword stabbed and slashed and shattered. I was wet and hot with the blood of my enemies. To protect themselves, they flapped their wings, lifted up higher, and dove. But they were never quick enough, and were hindered by the thickness of the trees, and my speed was beyond measure. I leaped and dodged, parried and thrust. I raged among the flapping demons like a lion among sheep. Finally, it was as if all the Birdmen in the world appeared. The sky darkened above me, and the darkness fell over me, and down they came in a fluttering wave of screeches and sword slashes and axe swings. I was a crazed dervish. I spun and slung my blade like the reaper's scythe, and once again they began to pile up. But then I was struck in the head from the side, and as I tumbled to the ground, I thought it was the end of me. I couldn't have been down but for a moment, when I felt a blade at my throat and heard a voice say, "No, bring him." Jarrell and I were lifted up and carried. My sword was gone. I was bleeding. I saw walking before the pack of Birdmen, Tordo, Jarrell's traitorous uncle. We were hoisted out of the forest and onto the trail, carried up toward the amazing twists of forest and stone. As we neared, I saw small clouds of smoke rising from stone chimneys, and in loops of groomed limbs, I saw large nests made of vines and sticks and all manner of refuse. The nests were wide open, but they were built under the great limbs and leaves of trees that served as a roof. Beyond them, there was an enormous tree, the biggest I had seen on my world or this one, and there was a gap in it that served as an opening into the city proper. A great drawbridge had been dropped, and it stretched out over a gap between trees and mountain, and the gap was wide and deep beyond comprehension. Over the drawbridge we were carried, and into the great fortress of wood and stone. My thought was that Jarrell was already dead, and I was next. And let me tell you, true as the direction north, I didn't care if I died. With Jarrell lost, I wished to die. As it turned out, I didn't die. And neither did Jarrell. I didn't realize she was alive until we found ourselves in the bowels of the fortress, in a prison that was deep inside the cave of a tree. A series of metal bars served as our doorway. Looking through the bars, I could see a long corridor that was also the inside of a tree, and there were two guards nearby, one with a lance, one with an axe, both with expressions that would make a child cry. In our cell, they dropped us down on some limbs and leaves that served as beds. There was a peculiar odor. The only thing I can equate it with is the smell of a hen house on a hot, damp afternoon. I knelt over Jarell, lifted her head gently. "My love," I said. "My head hurts," she said. The sound of her voice elated me. "I guess so. You took quite a lick." She sat up slowly. "Are you okay?" I got a bump myself, behind my ear. She gingerly touched it with the tips of her fingers. "Ow," she said. "My sentiments exactly. What I don't understand is why they didn't kill us." "I think, in my case, my uncle wants me to see the ceremony." "What ceremony?" "The linking of the two halves of the talisman. The acquisition of the greatest power on our planet. He wants me to see what he has achieved before he puts me to death. Wants me to know the deed is done and I have failed to prevent it. Then we die. If you ain't dead, you're living. And that's a good thing," I said. It took her a moment to take it in. It was as if whatever power allowed my words to be translated to her language had lost a beat. After a moment, she laughed her musical laugh. "I think I understand. We won't give up until we're beyond considering on the matter, one way or the other," I said. "I love you, Jack," she said, "and I you." We allowed ourselves a kiss. Yet in spite of my bravado, in spite of the repeating of my old sergeant's words, I feared it might be our last. "Love is a wonderful steed," said a voice. "Ride it as long as you can." We looked up, and there above us, sitting on a ridge of stone, was a birdman, his feet dangling. He looked youngish, if I can claim any ability of judging the age of a man who looks a lot like a giant chicken crossed with the body of a man. A very weak-looking chicken. He appeared near starved to death. His head hung weak. His ribs showed. His legs were skinny as sticks. But there was still something youthful about him. "Who are you?" I asked. It wasn't a brilliant question, but it was all I had. "Gar Don," he said, and dropped off the ledge, his wings taking hold with a fanning of air. He settled down near us, his legs weak and shaky. He sat down on the floor, his head sagged. He sighed. "I am a prisoner, same as you." "Gar Don," Jarell said, "the former king's son, his heir." That was how it was supposed to be. But no longer. I was usurped. "Conrad," said Jarell. "Yes," Gardon said. "Now he is king, and I am here, awaiting the moment when he is able to acquire the rest of the talisman, and from what I overheard, that moment has arrived." "Yes," Jarell said, "for all of us. I am Jarell, Princess of Sheldon." Gar Don lifted his head, took a deep breath, said, "I know of you. I am sorry for your fate and his." "Jack," I said, "I am called Jack." "I shall go out as a prince," Gar Don said. "I will not beg. My horror is not my death, but what the two halves of the talisman can do. Conrad will possess immense power." "What does this power do?" I asked. "We only have legend to explain it to us. It gives him the power over spirits and demons from the old trees." "The old trees?" I said. "Giant trees that contain spirits of power," Jarell said. "Those kinds of trees no longer exist. They ceased to exist before I was born, before my father was born, his grandfather, and so on. The spirits are contained in the two halves of the talisman. Conrad will be able to control the people then, Gardon said. They, like my father and myself, were perfectly happy with our peace treaty. Only an insane being wants war. The people only follow Conrad because they fear him. All uprisings have been destroyed, or the participants have gone into hiding. After today, they might as well never have existed, for he will control anyone and everyone with his new powers. He will not be able to be defeated. But you don't actually know how he will do that, I asked. I have only heard of the legend, Gardon said. The power of the spirits, the demons of the trees. Exactly what they are capable of, I do not know. Our people have always feared the talisman, and knowing now that it will be united, no one will resist him. It would be useless. There was a clatter of sound in the hallway. Gardon stood weakly and said, It seems we are about to find out the exactness of the talisman's power. They came for us, unlocking our cell, entering quickly. To be sure of our compliance, there was a horde of them with long spikes and strong nets and an angry attitude. I managed to hit one with my fist, knocking him to the floor in a swirl of dust and feathers. Jarrell kicked another. Gardon tried to fight, but he was as weak as a dove. They netted the three of us, bagged us, kicked us a while, then hauled us away like trapped vermin being taken to a lake to be drowned. We were brought to a large throne room that, like the overall stronghold, was made of stone and was combined with the natural strength of trees and limbs and leaves. Enormous branches jutted out of the walls high above our heads, and perched on them, like a murder of ravens, were birdmen and birdwomen, the first females I had seen of that race. An occasional feather drifted down from above, coasted in the light. Above that perch on which the bird people were seated was a tight canopy of leaves, so thick and layered it would have taken an army of strong warriors many days to hack their way through it. Actually, I'm not even sure they could do it in years. They brought us in and held us close to the floor in our nets. We could see through the gaps in the netting. Besides the bird people on the limbs above, the throne room was packed with others. Some of them warriors, many of them nobles, and some citizens. We were the spectacle, and all of the bird people had been summoned to witness whatever ceremony was at hand. I assumed it would not be a parade in our honor. On a dais was a throne, and on the throne was a large winged man who looked as if an ancient human being, fat of body, thin of legs, with a head like a warped melon, had been mated to a condor and a buzzard, all of him swathed over with warts and scars and age. A golden cloak draped his shoulders, and except for half the talisman on a chain around his neck, he wore nothing else. His eyes were dark and the color of old dried pine sap. This, of course, was King Conrad. Tordo stood near the throne, one hand on its back support. There were guards on either side of King Conrad and Tordo. The room was full of warriors as well. Conrad nodded at Tordo. Tordo stepped to the center of the dais, removed his half of the talisman from his neck, and lifted it up with both hands. Sunlight coming through an open gap behind the king glittered across the talisman like sunlight on a trout's back. What say you? Said the king. The crowd cheered. It sounded like the sort of cheers we buffalo soldiers used to give the lieutenant when he rode by on horseback. A white man who led us, like we couldn't lead ourselves, as if our color tainted our intelligence. It was a cheer, but it came from the mouth, not the soul. The king said, The old order is here. Gardon, son of the former king, who was not worthy and shall not be named, is also here. He will see how a true king shows his power. It is you who is not worthy, Gardon called out from his netted position on the floor. Strike him, said the king. One of the warriors stepped forward and brought the staff of his spear sharply across Gardon's back. Gardon grunted. We also have among us the daughter of King Rong of the Sheldan, said the king. A rather inferior race, in my opinion. Add a black man-thing that I cannot define, nor can anyone else, and we have three enemies of the throne. The gods will welcome their deaths. They will be the first to die by the power of the talisman. I will call up all the demons of the trees, and they will render these worthless creatures into wet rags. I know your law, Jor-El said, pushing herself to her knees under the net. I ask my right to challenge you, or your second. If I win, our lives will be spared. I am too old to be challenged, said the king. I have no intention of sullying myself with a duel. Nor will I sully one of my men. Why should I? You have the right by our law to make a challenge, and I, as king, have the right to refuse. I refuse. Be silent. King Conrad leaned forward on his throne. I could almost hear his bones creak. His wings trembled slightly. He looked like a gargoyle rocking on its ledge. He said to Tordo, "Bring me the power." Tordo hesitated, then moved toward him. King Conrad held out his hand. "Give it to me." Tordo held his half of the talisman forward with his left hand, and as the king reached to take it, Tordo sprang forward, snatched at the talisman around the king's neck, yanked it loose of its chain. Links of chain clattered on the floor as Tordo slammed the two pieces of the talisman together with a loud click. He lifted it above his head with a smile. He yelled out a series of words, an incantation. I understood the words, but not their jumbled purpose. And then the spell was finished, and, well, nothing. It was as quiet in the throne room as a mouse in house slippers. From somewhere in the crowd, there was a cough, as if someone had a mouthful of feathers, which, considering who was in the room, could have actually been the case. Tordo's gleeful expression died slowly. He said a word that didn't translate, but I had an idea what it meant. He turned slowly and looked over his shoulder. He had gone from a potential wizard of the trees to a fool with two connected pieces of jewelry. The guards hustled up from the bottom of the dais, their spears raised, ready to stick Tordo. No, said the king. Give me the talisman first. One of the warriors tugged it from Tordo's hands, removed his sword as well, gave the talisman to the king. The king held it in his hands. He looked at it the way a fisherman might look at his catch, realizing it had appeared much larger underwater. It is useless. It is a lie. He lifted his eyes to Tordo. I will make your death a long one. While they were so engaged and all eyes were on them, I lifted an edge of the net, crawled out from under it, and seized one of the birdmen. I drew his sword from its sheath and shoved him back. I sprang toward the dais. A warrior stepped in front of me, but I jabbed quickly, and the sharp blade went through his eye, and down he went. With my newfound abilities renewed, I leapt easily to the dais and put my sword to the king's throat. The guards on either side of the throne started toward me. I said to the king, "Give the order to free the lady and Gardon, or I will run this through your throat." The king's body shook. "Free them," he said. The net was lifted. The warriors around them parted. I noticed there was a rearranging of soldiers. Some shifted out of one group and into another. It was a good sign. They were showing their division. I said, "Those who wish the king well, fear the point of my sword. Those who wish him ill, perhaps you would enjoy my sword thrust. We shall see which is more popular." There was a slight murmur. By this time, Jarell and Gardon had joined me on the dais. They stood near me and the king. Jarell picked up the pike of the guard I had killed. Tordo hadn't moved. He feared to move. Gardon said, "I am your king. I am the son of the true king, who was the son of a king and the king before that. Today the talisman failed Conrad and Tordo. The spirits within it do not wish their will to succeed. They do not wish their powers used for something so pointless as killing and destruction and war. It is peace they want. It is peace they have allowed. And I suggest we obey their will and continue on that path, lest they turn on us and destroy us all." Someone said, "Gardon, our king." A moment later, this was repeated. Then someone else said the same, and voices rose up from the crowd and filled the room. And the voices came not from the mouths of the frightened, but from the souls of true believers. There were a few who, for a moment, seemed unwilling to make the change to Gardon, but they were vastly outnumbered, and those who tried to defend Conrad were quickly dispatched in a wave of bloody anger. If there was a lesson to be learned from Gardon's remarks about the talisman, they hadn't actually learned it, which meant the bird people were as human as the wingless. They were not ready to accept that the talisman was nothing more than an ancient myth. Gardon took the talisman, held it up as Tordo had done. He was still weak and struggled to hold it aloft, but his spirit was strong. He spoke so loudly, his words could be heard at the back of the room and up into the leafy canopy. "The power of the talisman will remain unused. Half of it will go back with Princess Jarell, back to her city and her king, where it will continue to remain powerless, and our peace will continue." "What of him?" said a bird woman, stepping forward to point a long finger at Tordo. Gardon turned his head to Tordo, studied him. He was about to speak when Jarell beat him to it. "Gardon, King of the Varnan," she said, "I ask you to sanction my right to combat with Tordo. He has stolen from my family. He has insulted my family. And I desire to insult him with the edge of my blade." "And if you lose," said Gardon. "I won't," Jarell said. "But if I do, let him go. Banish him." "Don't do this," I said. "Let me take your place. I am as good a warrior as any other, my love." "Very well," said Gardon. "But before that," he turned to the former King Conrad, "I banish you. As of now, you will rise, and you will go away, and you will never come back." The old man rose, and in that moment, seeing how weak he was, I almost felt sorry for him. Then a blade came out from under his cloak, and he stabbed at Gardon. I caught Conrad's arm just in time. Twisted. It snapped easily. He screeched and dropped the dagger. I let him go. Gardon leaned forward and looked into Conrad's eyes. "I see emptiness." Gardon weakly picked up the dagger Conrad had dropped. He seemed strong all of a sudden. "It will not matter what I do, Conrad. You are dead already." With that, he jammed the blade into the former king's chest. The old man collapsed in a cloaked wad, and immediately a pool of blood flowed around him. "Give Tordo a sword," Gardon said, turning back to the situation at hand. "Death is your loss, Tordo. Banishment is your victory." Jarell dropped the pike and was given a sword. Tordo was given a sword. All of the disappointment of the moment, every foul thing he was, bubbled up and spewed out of him. He attacked with a yell. He bounced forward on the balls of his feet, attempting to stick Jarrell. Jarrell glided back as if walking on air. Everyone on the dais moved wide of their blades as they battled back and forth, the throne sometimes coming between them. Once Jarrell slipped in Conrad's blood, and in spite of this being a private duel, I almost leapt to her aid, but Gardon touched me on the arm. "It is not done," he said. Torto put one boot on Conrad's lifeless neck and used it as a kind of support to lift him up and give him more of a downward thrust. But Jarrell slipped the lunge. Torto sprang off Conrad's lifeless neck and made a beautiful thrust for her face. I let out a gasp of air. It was right on target. At the last moment, Jarrell dropped under his thrust, which lifted the hair on her head slightly and drove her weapon up and into his belly. He held his position, as if waiting for his form to be admired, then made a noise like an old dog with a chicken bone in its throat, and fell flat on his face. Blood poured out of him and flowed into the puddle of gore that had fanned out from beneath Conrad. Jarrell studied the corpse of Torto for a moment. She took a deep breath, said, "I have drawn my kin's own blood, but I have avenged Torto's treachery and honored my father." Gardon stepped forward and surveyed the crowd. He lifted his chin slightly. The response to this was another cheer from the multitude, and this one was more than from the throat. It was from deep within the soul. There were great celebrations, and we were part of it. It was pleasant and necessary to the new agreement between kingdoms, but I was glad when it ended, and we were given back the mounts we had taken from the Gaul minions, sent on our way with supplies, fanfare, and of course, Jarrell's half of the talisman. As we rode along the wide trail in the morning light, winding down from the great lair of the bird people, I said, "Do you think Gardon's people believed what he said about the talisman?" "Perhaps they did," Jarrell said. "Perhaps some did. Perhaps none did. The only thing that matters is there was no great power when the two pieces were united. It's just a legend." "Designed to prevent war between your people and theirs," I said. "That seems like a legend worth believing. The halves of a great power, divided, so neither has a unique and overwhelming power over the other." "Devel would be amused," she said. We experienced a few adventures on our way to Jarrell's kingdom, but they were minor, mostly involving brigands we dispatched with little effort, a few encounters with wild beasts. When we arrived in the land of Sheldan and Jarrell explained all that had happened to her father, I was afforded much curiosity, mostly due to the color of my skin. I was thanked. I was rewarded with a fine sword and scabbard. I was given a prominent place at King Ron's table, and it was there that Jarrell told him that we were to marry. It was the first I had heard of it, but I was delighted with the idea. That was some time ago. I am sitting now at a writing desk in a great room in this Sheldan castle made of clay and stone. It is dark except for a small candle. I am writing with a feather pen on yellow parchment. My wife, the beautiful warrior Jarrell, sleeps not far away in our great round bed. Tonight, before I rose to write, I dreamed as I have the last three nights. In the dream, I was being pulled down a long, bright tunnel and finally into the cold, dark waters of the Atlantic, washing about in the icy waves like a cork. The great light of a ship moved my way, and in the shadows of that light were the bobbing heads of dying swimmers and the bouncing of the Titanic's human-stuffed rafts. The screams of the desperate, the cries of the dying, filled the air. I have no idea what the dream means, or if it means anything. But each night that I experience it, it seems a little clearer. Tonight there was another part to it. I glimpsed the thing that brought me here, pulled me down and through that lit tunnel to Venus. I fear it wishes to take me back. I finished this with no plans of its being read, and without complete understanding as to why I feel compelled to have written it. But written it is. Now I will put my pen and parchment away, blow out the candle, lie gently down beside my love, hoping I will never be forced to leave her side, and that she and this world will be mine forever.
Mike Resnick. Mike Resnick is one of the best-selling authors in science fiction and one of the most prolific. His many novels include Kirin Yaga, Santiago, The Dark Lady, Stalking the Unicorn, Birthright, The Book of Man, Paradise, Ivory, Soothsayer, Oracle, Lucifer Jones, Purgatory, Inferno, A Miracle of Rare Design, The Widowmaker, The Soul Eater, A Hunger in the Soul, The Return of Santiago, Starship Mercenary, Starship Rebel, and Stalking the Vampire. His collections include Will the Last Person to Leave the Planet Please Shut Off the Sun?, An Alien Land, A Safari of the Mind, Hunting the Snark and other short novels, and The Other Teddy Roosevelts. As editor, he's produced Inside the Funhouse, 17 SF stories about SF, What Dunnets, More What Dunnets, Shaggy BEM Stories, New Voices in Science Fiction, This Is My Funniest, a long string of anthologies co-edited with Martin H. Greenberg, Alternate Presidents, Alternate Kennedys, Alternate Warriors, Aladdin, Master of the Lamp, Dinosaur Fantastic, By Any Other Fame, Alternate Outlaws, and Sherlock Holmes in Orbit, among others, as well as two anthologies co-edited with Gardner Dozois, and Stars, original stories based on the songs of Janice Ian, edited with Janice Ian. He won the Hugo Award in 1989 for Kirin Yaga. He won another Hugo Award in 1991 for another story in the Kirin Yaga series, The Manamuki, and another Hugo and Nebula in 1995 for his novella, Seven Views of Olduvai Gorge. His most recent books are a number of new collections, The Incarceration of Captain Nebula and Other Lost Futures, Win Some, Lose Some, the Hugo Award-winning and nominated short science fiction and fantasy of Mike Resnick, and Masters of the Galaxy, and two new novels, The Doctor and the Rough Rider and The Doctor and the Dinosaurs. He lives with his wife Carol in Cincinnati, Ohio. Here, a soldier of fortune sets off into the hostile Venusian jungle in company with a very unusual partner in search of the most fabulous treasure on the planet, and finds much more than he bargained for.
The Godstone of Venus by Mike Resnick, read for you by Ron Donaghy. "Does it ever stop raining?" asked Scorpio, looking out the window as the rain splashed into the ocean. "They say it did once for almost a whole week, about 30 years ago," replied the bartender, carrying a pair of purple concoctions over to Scorpio, handing one to him and drinking the other himself as he walked back to the bar. Marcus Aurelius Scorpio was seated at a wooden table next to a large window. The tavern sat atop a huge rocky promontory, with a vast ocean surrounding three sides of it and a crushed rock path leading down to a dense jungle behind it. "That was a rhetorical question," replied Scorpio. "Yeah, you don't look drunk enough for it to be a serious one." "Yep," replied the bartender. "Where's your partner?" Scorpio shrugged. "Beats me. He'll be by later." "How do you ever hook up with something like him?" asked the bartender. "Or is he an it?" "Not unless one of his lady friends got mad at him since this morning," replied Scorpio. "You know, Venus has got a lot of races, some of them bright, some of them barely able to scratch without instructions. But your partner is the strangest of them all, or my name ain't Lucius Aloysius McEnany."
"When you get right down to it, your name isn't Lucius anymore. Most of the locals can't pronounce it, so it's Luke. But when I pay my taxes, it's Lucius,"
Scorpio looked amused.
When did you ever pay taxes?
Well, if I did, said McEnany, it'd be as Lucius.
I think I'll go back to listening to the rain hit the windows, said Scorpio. It makes more sense.
McEnany was about to reply, when he was drowned out by the hooting of a huge golden fish that stuck its head out of the tank that rested on a shelf behind the bar.
All right, he muttered,
pouring the remainder of his drink into the tank. The fish swam right through the spreading purple liquid, hooted happily, and turned a trio of back somersaults.
Look at that, said McEnany disgustedly. A goddamned alcoholic fish.
He pointed to a bright orange creature that hung upside down on the ceiling.
And what passes for a bat on this idiot world and eats nothing but cigar butts? Damn lucky for him, none of the Venusian races ever get lung cancer. Probably just the bartenders.
He paused, then slammed a fist down on the bar.
What the hell are a couple of Earthmen like us doing on this godforsaken world anyway? Drinking purple stuff? Damn it, you know what I mean, growled McEnany. I could have been a bartender back in Klamath Falls. I mean, hell, we had enough goddamn water there. No, I had to come to the planet of opportunity to make my millions.
He spat on the bare wooden floor.
Opportunity, my ass.
So go home, said Scorpio.
And do what?
I'm 63 years old and I've been bartending here for more than 30 years. I'm too old to retrain.
So go home and tend bar there.
To tell the truth, I'm afraid to, admitted McEnany. 30 years is a long time. Who the hell knows what it's like there now?
Scorpio made no reply, and McEnany glared at him.
Anyone ever tell you that sympathy's not your long and strong suit?
From time to time. Didn't have any effect on you then either, I'll bet.
Scorpio looked over McEnany's shoulder at the door, which was just opening. A couple walked in, drenched despite all their protections against the weather.
Hell of a day, muttered the burly man,
removing his outer garments and tossing them carelessly on the end of the bar, revealing a pockmarked mustached face with a thick head of wavy grey hair. He then helped the woman out of her protective gear, and Scorpio saw that she was a curvaceous, expensively clad woman, or at least female, with light blue skin and matching hair.
Pretty much the same as all the other days round here, replied McEnany.
That is a depressing thought, said the woman. What have you got to drink?
You name it, I've either got it or I'll fake it.
The woman looked at Scorpio.
I'll have what that man is drinking.
Me too, said the man.
He turned to the bartender.
I'm supposed to meet someone here?
Must be him, said McEnany, gesturing to Scorpio. Ain't no one else been here all day.
The man approached Scorpio.
Are you the one they call the Scorpion?
At your service, replied Scorpio. You must be Rand Quintaro.
Quintaro nodded and extended his hand, then sat down and gestured the woman to sit next to him, which she did.
You could have chosen a more convenient place, he said.
This is my office when I'm on Venus, replied Scorpio.
I understand you have a partner, continued Quintaro.
Where is he?
He'll be along. We'll wait.
That's up to you, said Scorpio. Could be a couple of days.
He's on a job?
Asked Quintaro.
It's confidential. I can't discuss it.
The man nodded his head knowingly. McEnany emitted a sarcastic snort, then brought the blue-skinned woman her drink.
It's strong,
she breathed after taking a sip.
I can dilute it, offered McEnany.
No, she said, never taking her eyes off Scorpio. I like strong.
You got a name, lady?
It's Sapphire, she replied.
Sapphire what? Asked McEnany.
Just Sapphire.
Pleased to meet you, Just Sapphire, said Scorpio.
He turned back to Quintaro.
You sure you don't want to talk a little business now?
Quintaro sighed and his mustache quivered.
All right, there's no sense wasting any more time. It took me 2 months just to decide you and your partner were the men for the job.
He's not exactly a man, noted Scorpio.
Anyway, you come highly recommended. I'd ask by who, but you'd probably tell me and I'd have to lecture you about the company you keep, said Scorpio with just a trace of a smile. McEnany looked at a small screen that was hidden behind the bar. He's coming, he announced. Your partner? Asked Quintaro. Scorpio nodded. I guess he accomplished his mission faster than anticipated.
Shut up, said a familiar voice inside his head. A moment later the door opened, and a strange-looking creature entered. He was a dark blue quadruped, perhaps the size of a mastiff. He had four nostrils, two in front, one on each cheek, eyes that seemed to glow even though they were totally shielded from the dim lights, and a tail that ended in such a sharp point that it could very well be used as a weapon. He was covered by a dull, curly down, and when he opened his mouth he displayed a double row of coal-black fangs.
"This is Merlin," announced Scorpio. "He doesn't talk, but he understands everything you say."
Quintaro studied Merlin for a moment.
"I've never seen anything like him," he said. "What world is he from? This one? Really?" "Why would I lie to you?" said Scorpio. "Not every planet produces just one sentient race."
Quintaro stared at Merlin for another moment, then shrugged and turned back to Scorpio.
"He won't be offended if I speak directly to you. I'd feel awkward speaking to him. I just may bite his foot off." Practice a little anger management, thought Scorpio. "I got the repair estimate on the ship while you were off hunting for lady friends, and we need a quick 73,000 mojuri or we're stuck on this ball of dirt, well, ball of jungle and water." 73,000 mojuri? That's outrageous.
Probably, agreed Scorpio.
How much is that in real money? 20,000 credits. That's why you're not biting his foot off. Yet.
Scorpio turned to Quintaro.
All right, we're all ears. What exactly are you here about?
I want to hire your services, said Quintaro.
Which particular services?
Whatever's required. I'll be honest, I expect to run into some danger in the pursuit of my goal, and I'm told you're the deadliest man on Venus now that Cemetery Smith has moved to Titan.
Suppose you tell me what goal you're in pursuit of, said Scorpio. Quintaro leaned forward.
Have you ever heard of the Godstone of Venus?
Scorpio shook his head.
What is it, some kind of gem or a carving or what?
I don't know, answered Quintaro. Scorpio frowned.
Then what do you want it for? It's supposed to imbue its possessor with certain mystical powers. You've been reading too many bad adventure stories, Mr. Quintaro, said Scorpio. It exists, insisted Quintaro. Even if it's just a stone with no mystical powers, it's worth a king's ransom. Man and Venusians have been searching for it for eons.
Suddenly a sly smile crossed his face.
But I've got something they didn't have.
Let me guess, said Scorpio in bored tones.
An ancient treasure map?
Even better, said Quintaro, pointing at Sapphire.
I've got her.
Scorpio turned to look at Sapphire, who hadn't said a word since commenting on her drink.
What do you think you know? He asked.
It was my race that created the Godstone, she said, and my race that hid it.
What makes you think you can find it, no matter who created and hid it? Demanded Scorpio.
My race is not like yours, she said. We are born with a racial memory, back to the very first member of our species that crawled up out of the sea, breathed air, and developed limbs.
If every member of your race knows where it is, what makes you think one of them hasn't found it already?
I would know if they had, said Sapphire.
Anyway, said Quintaro, it's not necessary that you believe in the stone. Just believe in the money.
He paused.
You just have to lead us to where she knows it is, and I'll offer you 30,000 credits for the job in any currency that's accepted in the system, half now and half when we find it, or when we reach the location and it's not there.
30,000 buys us for 1 month maximum, replied Scorpio.
It's a deal. We don't want any part of this, said Merlin wordlessly. Why not? He doesn't have the slightest idea what he's after. She put him up to this, and that description, vague as it was, of a godstone was planted in his mind by her. I was born on Venus, and I've never heard of it. As for him, he plans to kill us and take back the down payment when we reach our destination. Then read her mind, and see if the damn thing really exists. I can't.
Scorpio frowned.
You never came across a sentient being of any race where you couldn't read their minds, or at least their emotions. This one's different, came Merlin's answer. She looks human, but she's not. Not human, and not a mutation, as far as I can tell. Is she Venusian? I don't know. What do you know about her? Nothing. And that scares me. I've never seen you afraid of anything before. Now you're scaring me.
Well, Scorpion, said Quintaro.
We need the money, thought Scorpio, and we'll be on our guard. What the hell? The breeding season's ending. I take that as an agreement. Yeah, thought Merlin. This really isn't much of a world once the females are out of heat. I'm sure they share that conviction.
All right, Mr. Quintaro, said Scorpio. You've got yourself a deal. I assume you paused because you were consulting with your partner.
Assuage his fears, thought Merlin.
Yeah. Scorpio blinked his eyes rapidly and shook his head. Whenever he's reading my mind, he lied, I feel a kind of buzzing inside my head and I go blank for a moment.
Quintaro, convinced that his plans and motives remained unknown, relaxed noticeably.
We'll start in the morning, he announced. I've got the transportation we'll need.
Where are you staying? Asked Scorpio.
We thought we'd spend the night here.
Scorpio turned to McEnany.
Got a spare room?
Got five of them,
answered the bartender.
Well, now you have four, said Scorpio.
He turned back to Quintaro.
Where's your vehicle?
Down the trail a bit, he answered, gesturing towards the door.
It had better be a VZ Model 3 or 4, said Scorpio. Anything else will sink right into this mud if it's carrying the four of us plus our gear.
It's a VZ-4, confirmed Quintaro.
Okay, said Scorpio. All that's left is your down payment.
Quintaro reached into a pocket, pulled out a wad of 1,000 credit notes, peeled off 15 of them and pushed them across the table to Scorpio. Scorpio pocketed the money and turned to Sapphire.
You don't say much, do you?
Not much, she agreed.
How did you two meet?
Was the strangest damn thing, said Quintaro. I was actually getting set to take my leave of this world. I hear they've discovered a couple of truly phenomenal diamond pipes on Ganymede, and since I'm a jeweler by trade, I was thinking of going there.
He's lying. He's a gambler, and he's got a criminal record as long as your arm.
When I ran into this lovely lady as I was checking out of my hotel by the Amber City spaceport, we got to talking, found we had a lot in common, and eventually she mentioned the Godstone. Well, hell, everyone on Venus has heard about it.
Not me, said Scorpio.
Not him either, until she planted his interest in his head.
Well, you're a transient, said Quintaro. People talk about you all over the system. I've heard about your exploits on Mars and half a dozen moons. They say you can't go back to Earth, but I figure that's either just romantic bullshit or else at least you had a good reason for whatever you did.
You don't have to sell, Mr. Quintaro, said Scorpio. I've already accepted your offer.
Anyway, it's perfectly understandable that someone who spends so little time here or anywhere wouldn't know about the Godstone.
Interesting name, Godstone, said Scorpio.
I find it very evocative. Even if it was worthless, I'd spend this much money just to say I was the guy who found it.
Well, I hope we can make you feel you've gotten your money's worth, said Scorpio.
We'll be leaving at daybreak, which comes pretty early around here. You might want to grab some sleep.
Good idea, said Quintaro.
He got to his feet.
Come, my dear.
Sapphire stood up with an alien grace, linked her arm in his, and walked to the door.
Where is our room?
Quintaro asked McEnany.
Down the corridor, last room on the right, answered the bartender. Door's unlocked.
You just stay in one night. I'll lock it from here once you're inside the room and just open it tomorrow when you're leaving.
Thanks, said Quintaro.
He handed a bill to McEnany.
This ought to cover it.
That'll buy you 3 rooms, answered McEnany, each with a woman in it.
Suddenly, he looked embarrassed.
Sorry, Miss Sapphire, ma'am, just a figure of speech.
She'd shown no annoyance when he uttered the remark, and she showed no reaction when he apologized. A moment later, the couple walked out of the bar and down the corridor, and though they were still arm in arm, Scorpio got the feeling that she was leading him. He got up and placed his empty glass on the bar.
You ever heard of this Godstone? He asked.
McEnany shook his head.
Nope. He makes it sound like you and me are the only ones who haven't.
Yeah, said Scorpio.
Well, don't believe everything you hear.
He looked over at Merlin.
You all through making a new generation? We've got work to do if we're heading out in the morning.
My race has sexual seasons just like many mammals on your homeworld. Live with it. At least I'm not chasing a new female on every world we visit like some partners I could mention. Only because it wouldn't do you the least bit of good, thought Scorpio. Now, what kind of equipment are we going to need for this foolishness? It's only foolish if you consider Quintaro. He thinks he's looking for a valuable gem, and he intends to kill us when he finds it. It's probably just what he hopes it is. Something worth a few million on the black market, or even the open market if the government doesn't claim it as a planetary treasure. Don't think about it or him. She is the wild card. She's one of the better-looking cards in the deck. That is all you can say or think after what I've told you? What do you want me to say? Idiot.
Scorpio reached behind the bar, grabbed a bottle, and filled his glass.
You look annoyed, noted McEnany.
There were 2 blue creatures in this place, answered Scorpio. Quintaro went off with the gorgeous one, and I'm stuck with the ugly one who doesn't trust anyone, including his partner.
If he's worried about you running off with the money that guy gave you, I can stick it in the safe until you get back, offered McEnany.
Bad trade, muttered Scorpio.
Trade? What trade?
You get 15,000 credits, and I get a deserted, beat-up tavern when I get back.
You think I'd do that to you?
Said McEnany in hurt tones.
Even Merlin thinks so, and he hates to agree with me.
Scorpio picked up his bottle and began walking to the door.
Unlock my room for me. I got a feeling this is the last night I'm going to be sleeping in a bed for a month.
Scorpio dragged himself out of bed at sunrise, staggered to the bathroom and rinsed his face off. He wasn't thrilled with the smell or taste of Venus's water, but he remembered all the worlds where water was almost impossible to come by. He considered shaving, decided not to, stuck a trio of fresh outfits into a cloth bag, slung it over his shoulder, strapped on a holster and a modified laser pistol, donned his boots and walked out into the corridor, almost tripping over Merlin.
Good morning, said the Venusian, silently. I think what I hate most about you is that you never have to sleep, Scorpio replied grumpily. Right. It's only saved your life 3 or 4 times. Okay, I'll find something else to hate about you. Where are our clients? Up or still snoring? They were eating what passes for breakfast in the bar about an hour ago. They're outside now.
Why? Said Scorpio aloud. It's been pouring for the past month. I can't imagine it stopped in the last 6 hours.
They've got all kinds of protective gear. Also, I think they're probably sitting in the vehicle.
A car or a boat?
A little of each, I think.
And there's room for all 4 of us and our gear, said Scorpio. This guy's not a piker.
Whatever that is.
Okay. Well, we might as well get this show on the road, said Scorpio,
walking down the crushed rock path with Merlin falling into step behind him. He descended until the ground leveled out and came to the Venusian version of a safari car, an amphibious vehicle that could negotiate oceans, rivers, streams, muddy jungles, just about every kind of unfriendly landscape the planet could provide. Scorpio briefly looked up from force of habit, but there was no sun to be seen, nor had there been in many millennia, just incredibly thick cloud cover. He then paused to wipe the rain from his face.
Good morning, Scorpion,
said Quintaro from where he and Sapphire sat in the back of the vehicle.
I assume you're doing the driving, that is, unless your partner can.
I'll drive, answered Scorpio, tossing his bag into the very back.
Nice vehicle.
Actually, it belongs to a friend, and the friend has issued an arrest warrant against him for stealing it.
You're surprised? Thought Scorpio. He opened the door for Merlin, waited for his partner to find a comfortable position in a vehicle that was never meant for his species.
Where's the control? He asked.
This is the latest model, answered Quintaro. Put your thumb on the pad there. Yes, that's right. Now, as long as you keep your thumb there, it'll follow your orders, whether on land or water. That green button on the side of it will morph it into a boat or whatever else we need.
Scorpio mentally ordered the vehicle to move forward slowly, down the crushed stone path leading away from the tavern, and it was soon skimming over the muddy jungle trail.
Got the hang of it? Asked Quintaro.
Yeah, answered Scorpio. I've never driven anything as expensive as one of these VZ-4s, but I've piloted ships that responded to mental commands.
This is a goddamn vehicle, not a ship, said Quintaro irritably. Just remember that.
It was the first time his smooth facade had slipped, and Scorpio wondered why.
He's scared to death.
Why? We're not going for a friendly ride in the park. Most people who go more than a few miles into this jungle don't come out. That goes for my race, too. Shit. We didn't charge him enough. I told you not to take it.
They'd gone a mile into the jungle when Scorpio saw something moving off to his left, something large. He stopped the vehicle and stared.
What is it? Asked Quintaro nervously.
I don't know. Merlin, has Venus got something black and shaggy about the height of a Tritonian limax, only half again as long?
It's a herbivore. Even herbivores can kill you when they're that big. We'll give him a wide berth.
Well, what does he say?
He says yes, lied Scorpio, partially to see the man's reaction, but mostly to see if Sapphire would contradict him. He checked her reaction on a small dashboard screen and saw that she was smiling in amusement.
Well, as long as we're going to be cooped up in this thing for a while, perhaps Sapphire will enlighten my partner and me about the history of the Godstone.
Why bother? Thought Merlin. If she's lying, and she probably will be, I won't be able to tell. There's got to be a little truth to it. Maybe like a famous detective of literature, we can construct the comprehensive whole from some of the disparate parts. Oh well, we've got nothing better to do.
Miss Sapphire, ma'am, said Scorpion.
It is the greatest treasure on all of Venus, she replied emotionlessly, as if by rote. The man who finds it will become wealthy beyond all imagining.
What's it made of?
I'm no meteorologist.
Neither am I, said Scorpio. But if I was spending all this money and possibly risking my life, I'd sure as hell know what I think it's made of.
Rare stones, she replied. Rarer than diamonds, than rubies, than emeralds, stones that exist nowhere else in the universe.
Possible? Asked Scorpio. I'm no gemologist. It seems unlikely, except why has she taken over Quintaro's mind, and why is she risking her life by coming along?
Are there any holographs of it?
Asked Scorpio. Not to my knowledge, replied Sapphire.
Does it show up in any history books?
Of course. That's how I know it exists.
Which ones?
I can't remember.
I don't have to read her mind to know she's lying, thought Scorpio. I still can't read it. All I get is a feeling of danger. Let me know when it feels imminent.
You'll know,
replied Merlin with absolute certainty.